prepare ourselves for Purim, which is 2 weeks from tonight, by taking a look at some sources that deal with the problem of two innovations that Purim brought along with it. One innovation, which is the introduction of a new book into the canon, which is Megillat Esther, and the second is the establishment of a new holiday, which is Purim. Okay? The problems may not be as big as I just made them out to be, because the problem of adding a new book into the canon really should not be an issue. After all, there was no canon yet at the time of Esther. And so if another book was written, Beruach HaKodesh, I mean, what's the problem with recognizing it as such and applying some measure of sanctity to it, etc.? Unclear. The bigger problem, the thornier problem, is the adding of a holiday, but then again, is that really a problem either? What would be the problem in adding a holiday to the calendar? Now, there would definitely be a problem if you were to ascribe Kedushat HaYom to the day, the sanctity of the day, which would involve an Easter Malacha, etc., then certainly that would be a problem. And what would the problem be? It would be a violation of Lotosif. Lotosif, of adding to the Torah's, but to determine that a particular day should be recognized as an annual day of thanksgiving to God for a miracle, unclear why that's really such a problem. So let's take a look at it, and you're going to find the discussion here which is exclusive to Purim, although if you think about it, it need not be. So what we're looking at is the sources that deal with the problem, and then we're going to address it from the perspective of the text. The sources that deal with the problem of these two additions or these two innovations, and then we'll ask the question, why are these addressed only in regards to Esther and to Purim? And then we'll take a look at the sources and hopefully get some sort of clue. We're going to start with the Pasuk in Vayikra. In Sefer Vayikra, at the very end, the very last pasuk of Vayikra, Ela haMitzvot asher tivah Adonai Moshe al bnei Yisrael b'har Sinai. Now, the word Ela generally is an inclusive word. It means we're now grouping all the things that have just been mentioned and saying these are all the mitzvot that were given at Har Sinai, and that's a critical piece of the puzzle because, of course, Sefer Vayikra starts not on top of Har Sinai but rather at the foot of Har Sinai in the Mishkan. Very nice. However, Chachamim understand the word Ela not to just be inclusive, but also to be exclusive. And very problematic because a famous Midrash that shows up about three or four different times in Bavli. Ela mitzvot she'en navi ati v'chadesh tavar mi'ata, or the proper wording may be rishai v'chadesh tavar mi'ata. That no navi can institute a new law from here on. Now, a little bit of a problem here, because this is not the last pasuk in Dvarim. It's the last pasuk in Vayikra. And Vayikra is certainly not the end of all the mitzvot. We have, besides the whole Dvarim issue, which is beyond the scope we could talk about, how to understand Sefer Dvarim, is in Bamidbar, you have a whole host of mitzvot that never showed up before. Paraduman, Taratamet, and Taratumat Mate, and Trumot, and Chala, and Nesachim, whole scads of mitzvot that show up in Sefer Bamidbar. It's a little hard to say that Ela really is a stopper. So I think we have to read the Pasuk a little differently, meaning read the Pasuk differently to understand the Midrash. Ela HaMitzvot, Asher Tzivah Adonai Moshe al Bnei Yisrael. The focus is not just on Ela, but it's on Moshe. That these are the mitzvot that Hashem commanded Moshe b'Har Sinai, and the notion here is that Moshe is the only lawgiver who is legitimate, meaning that as a Navi, and this is the two things we have to read into, it's not just Elah mitzvot, meaning everything till Vayikra is legit, everything afterwards is not, because that's preposterous. But it means that Moshe is the only Navi who can operate as a lawgiver. And the exclusivity is to say that the mitzvot that Hashem gave Moshe on Har Sinai, that's the sum total of mitzvot. You can't add anything more. Curiously, this question is raised in the context of several relatively minor innovations, including the innovation of sofiot, of final letters, into the writing, which of course is very bizarre because it only shows up in Ketav Ashuri, not in Ketav Ivri, but in any case, and not in the context of, shall we say, Chanukah. In the context of Chanukah, Nobody is bothered by the idea that every year for these 8 days we're going to do a mitzvah of lighting candles. The only thing that we're bothered by is, how can we say a bracha shekidishanu, very famous sugya. But nobody asks what right do you have to make up a day in which you're going to light candles. But they're very bothered by the addition of Purim. And why is that? It seems that from this source, the problem is not so much the addition of the holiday, but the addition of the holiday as a prophetic command. And that's the problem. All right, so let's take a look at the sources. Tanu Rabbanan, we have two sources from the Bavli and one from the Yerushalmi, and then we'll go on. And for Jason's benefit, again, I listed some questions here. They may or may not be the questions we asked, but they're questions. Tanu Rabbanan, Arba'im u'shmonen nevi'im v'sheva nevi'ot nidabu lehem l'Yisrael. By the way, that line alone is worth a whole shiur, and someday we'll do it, which is, who are these sheva nevi'ot? Who are these Arba'im u'shmonen nevi'im? And what ranks them as nevi'im? But in any case, for right now, we're saying the canonical list of 55 prophets, v'lo pichatu v'lo tiro mashkatu basorah. They did not add to or take away from the Torah. Of course, it's a little hard to say that considering one of the 48 men is Moshe. But okay. Chutzim mikra migilat. The only thing that they added to the Torah. They didn't take anything away. We're going to ignore the fact that Eliyahu suspended the law of Shchutei Chutz and several other examples of suspensions. But they didn't permanently affix any addition or remove anything, clearly, except for mikra migilat. So my drush, and it's kind of like, how did they justify it? All right, so let's see. I'm Rabbi Chiya bar Avina, Rabbi Shur ben Korcha, Uma me'avdu v'cherut amrinan shira, mimita l'chayim lo kol shekein. So now, the innovation here is not the composition and canonization of Mikra Megillah, but the mitzvah of Mikra Megillah. How can you have this mitzvah called Mikra Megillah? That is because Kal v'chomer. If we praise God when we were liberated from slavery, how much more so we should praise God when we're spared from death? This is very problematic. Right? Because first of all, maximum that you could say would be, fine, say Hallel on the 14th of Adar every year. Right? Kavachomer, if that's what you want to say. But if so, then why limit it to Purim? Why not extend it to all sorts of other circumstances where we were spared? The day that Yael killed Sisera, as an example. Okay? Kind of difficult. We then have another source which seems to cut in a slightly different direction earlier in Megillah and Daf Zayin. I'm Rav Shmuel bar Yehuda. Shacham on Esther l'Chachamim. So there are two purported conversations between Esther in Shushan and the Chachamim, ostensibly in Yerushalayim. Kiva'uni l'dorot, meaning I want my holiday to be an established holiday forever. Shachula, they sent back a message. Kinat morer tolin l'veinu mot. You're going to create jealousy among the nations. In other words, we're celebrating the defeat of the Persians and slaughtering of all these guys. You're going to create a big anti-Semitic backlash. They probably didn't say anti-Semitic because that would be an anachronism, but you know what I mean. Shachalam. So what did she say? Kfar ktuva ani al divrei hayamim machem adai faras. She says, the story's already written. It's a public story. Now, it's not exactly the case, because what is their supposed challenge? If you go every year and have a big parade and celebrate like that, you're going to raise a lot of jealousy. To answer, say, well, it's already documented, doesn't really answer the question, because most people aren't reading the annals of the kings of Persia on a regular basis. But if you go in their face with flags and costumes and all of that, it's going to be a different sort of story. It's a very strange response. Okay. Rav Chanina, Rav Yochanan, Rav Chaviva Matnu. So we have an interesting little internal note here in the Gemara. It records Chachamim, both from Bavel and Eretz Yisrael, and it notes that the Chule Seder Moed Kokei Aizuga, every time you find that foursome in Moed, Chaluf Rabbi Yochanan Uma'ayel Rabbi Yonatan. It should really be Rabbi Yonatan, not Rabbi Yochanan, and that's a timing issue, etc. Okay, what did they say? Shalchalahem Esther l'Chachamim. She sent another message, which was Kitvuni l'Dorot. And what's that request? I want Megillat Esther to be in the canon. I want my text to be sanctified. Shalchula. So they sent back a message. What was the message? They sent back a quote from Mishlei. The quote is Lokatnati lach Shalishim. Now, Shalishim doesn't mean threefold, it means something else. But the drush is Shalishim v'lo revaim, meaning, I have written this three times and not four times, as if to say that part of Mishlei's advice is don't commemorate something more than three times. And there's already three times that you're commemorated. Where is Esther ever commemorated once? Much less three times. So the answer that courses through the Bavli's discussion here is that the entire episode of Purim is a manifestation of the war against Amalek. And that Esther's only possible argument for saying my text should be canonized is because it's an expression of the war against Amalek. And Chachamim's answer is we've already gotten written three times, which is when they attack in Bishalach, when we're commanded to wipe them out in Zachor, and the story of Shaul and Amalek. We, by the way, are ignoring David and Amalek because it's just not convenient for the drasha. Right? David and Amalek in Shmuel Aleph, Perek Lamed, Ayin Sham. In any case, Ad Shematzulo Mikra Katu BaTorah. What does that mean, Ad Shematzulo? And I'm focusing on these little stitching statements because they're actually critical for understanding what's going on. Ad Shematzulo or Matzula Mikra Katu BaTorah.
They found her a source.
Meaning they were looking for a source. Their first instinct was to say, Shein Yishchim in Daimol, it's already written three times. But then they said, oh, we found sort of a crowbar here, which is Katuba Torah Ktob Zot Zikaron BaSefer. What's that? When Hashem tells Moshe after the skirmish with Amalek, and you can't call it more than a skirmish because there were no winners or losers out of that. We beat Amalek off. We weren't defeated, but we didn't beat them. So after that draw, Hashem said to Moshe, Ktob Zot Zikaron BaSefer. What does that mean? Ktob Zot. So Zot means Mashkatuv Kan Mishneh Torah, the event of Amalek here, which is the war against Amalek and the commitment to remember what they did and wipe them out. That's all part of one story. Zikaron, what's that? Mashkatuv Banvi'im, that's Shaul. Basefer Mashkatuv Bamegillah, so there's room for a third mention. And sort of the crowbar that gets it in is to say, oh, we agree with you, with your principle, which is that Amalek should not be mentioned. That's, by the way, this is something we're supposed to be wiping out. But Amalek should not be mentioned more than three times. So what's the legitimation? Is that the mention in Bishalach and the mention in Kiteitse is all one thing, which is true. Because the one in Kiteitse is, remember what they did in Bishalach. It doesn't say that there. They did in Bishalach. Remember what they did when we left Egypt and wiped them out. So it's all one mention. The Shaul Amalek episode is a second mention, and therefore there's room for a third mention, which is your story. Very nice. Okay. What it sounds like is happening is that there is, if you will, a problem that is larger than it need be with a solution that is far weaker than it could be. That's what it looks like. So let's take a look at the Talmud Yerushalmi, kind of a different angle on this. Talmud Yerushalmi records the following. Now, remember, Rabbi Yonatan was one of the Chachamim involved in the last discussion. But this is how it was reported in the Bavli. Here's the Yerushalmi. Shmonim b'chamisha zekinim. Now, this is something that does not show up in the Bavli at all. 85 elders, umayam shloshim v'kama nevi'im, 30-plus nevi'im out of those Chachamim, which means this goes back to the prophetic era. Hayu mitzta'arin ala devar hazeh. They were very bothered by this. What's the this? The mitzvah of Mikra Megillah being instituted. K'tiv, eila mitzvot asher tzivah Adonai Moshe. So they go back to our pasuk, and they say, eila mitzvot shinstavinu pi Moshe. V'chach amar lanu Moshe. Ein navi acher atid v'chadesh davar lachem me'ata. So Moshe gave us his mitzvot, and what did Moshe tell us? That's it. No more nevi'im instituting mitzvot. By the way, time out. Now we can ask the question, why doesn't anybody raise this question about Hanukkah? Because Hanukkah is never suggested as a prophetic institution. Right? Hanukkah is suggested as a takanat chachamim. Meaning that chachamim decided of their own accord, we have to extend the notion of shira and of praise for God and thanksgiving to God to this event.
What's
okay?
The manifest difference
to
that?
So you tell me, what's the manifest difference between a Navi giving a mitzvah and chachamim giving a mitzvah?
Not the manifest difference, not the form
and
Hanukkah exactly the same.
Except that what's the source difference? That's the issue that they're dealing with.
I get it, but that's why I say manifest. Okay, so source is different. How does that actually make it different in the experience?
And not in the experience, but in the legitimacy. That's the problem. We're dealing with legitimacy. What's the legitimacy for us having this holiday called Purim And the problem raised is that the holiday is presented as a prophetic innovation, not as a baked-in innovation. Baked-in innovation, we're not bothered by. Notice, nobody asked us about Netilat Yadayim, nobody asked us about Erev Tavshilin, nobody asked us about Hallel, or about any other of the things that are innovated by Chazal. The only one that they raise us about is Purim.
Who's the prophet?
Good question. Who's the prophet? Good question. Exactly. A bigger part of the problem. That's why I said it's a problem that's larger than it needs to be, with a solution that's worse than it could be. We could ignore it and say it's not a problem. Chachamim establish expansions on Torah ideals by creating mitzvot Rabbanan. We have a mitzvah of tahara. Chachamim extend it to the Netilat Yadayim. We have a notion of Shira, Chachamim establish Hallel. It's not such a problem. So in the same way, we have a notion of Hoda'ah. This is a day a great miracle happened. Chachamim establish a holiday. Not such a big problem. Okay? So let's take a look at what happens in the Yerushalmi, and then I'll take a question. Take a look at Mordechai and Esther Makshim Machadesh Lanu Davar. This is the Yerushalmi's take on it. Mordechai and Esther are asking us to legitimate a new holiday. And here we have this record that Moshe Rabbeinu said, that's it. Lo zazu misham nosim v'notnim badavar. So they kept discussing it. Ad she'ira kodesh baruch v'teneihem matzu otak tuvah b'torah uva nevi'im uva k'tuvim. Now notice, this looks very much like the last source we saw in the Bavli, and it's nothing like it. It has the same source, but it doesn't deal with it the same way. They found an allusion to it in Torah, nevi'im u'k'tuvim. That's important to note. The division of Tanakh in Torah, nevi'im u'k'tuvim is very late. It's not like Moshe Rabbeinu said, okay, that's it for the Torah, let's start the Nun section. Right? As a matter of fact, from the last chapter of Yoshua, it looks like Yoshua intended to add Sefer Yoshua to the Torah. Right? Now, continue Torah. The notion of dividing it into this tripartite division and to then explain it somehow, because it's very difficult to explain why certain things are Nevim, why certain things are Ketuvim. Shmuel supposedly wrote Megillat Rut. If that's the case, then why is Rut in Ketuvim and Shmuel's in Nevim? Yirmiyahu wrote Echa. Why is Yirmiyahu in Nevi'im and Echa's in Ketuvim? Right? Yeah, but Shlomo doesn't have a contribution to Nevi'im. That's less of a problem. Right? But here you have people who are absolutely considered to be Nevi'im, and their books are in the books of Nevi'im. And they also wrote other books, and if you say that Moshe Rabbeinu was the author of Eov, which is one of the opinions, then, nochamo, we have a big problem here. So let's take a look at what the solution in Yerushalmi is. And then we're going to open up a text and see if we can find a solution. Alright? Which should remind you of a very famous passage in the Bavli, Dafka Megillah, which you may be familiar with from liturgy. Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Kol makom she'ata motzei gedulato shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu shama ata motzei in vetanuto, davar zeh katuv batorah, v'shanui banevi'im u'mishulash baktuvim. And they bring psukim from Torah, from Nevi'im, and Ketuvim to demonstrate that wherever there's a mention of God's greatness, there's a mention of his humility. So this notion of finding something in all three sections of Tanakh seems to be pretty strong. Again, it sounds like the last piece in the Bavli, but it's not. How do we know that? Vayomer Adonai Moshe, Ktov Zot Zikaron Basefer. Remember, that's the pasuk that after the event with Amalek. And now we do the following. What's Zot? Zot hints to the Torah. How do I know that? Because Zot HaTorah, Shasam Moshe. Web Zikaron. Zikaron is an allusion to the Nevi'im, which is Vayikatev Sefer Zikaron Lefanav at the end of Malachi. And what's Basefer? Basefer is an allusion to Ketuvim. How do we know that a Sefer is allusion to Ketuvim? Because Umamar Esther is the end of Megillat Esther. Kiyam Etivra Purim Ha'ilev Nichtav Basefer. So now this is a very different take. This isn't saying we found a justification because there's room for three mentions, depending how we interpret Ktov Zot Zikaron Basefer, like the Bavli had it. This is saying that when Moshe originally got the commandment to remember what Amalek did, he was told to have a commemoration in all three modes of revelation, in the direct mode of Torah, the prophetic mode of Nevi'im, and then the inspired mode of Ketuvim, as the Rambam would have it, the right Ruach HaKodesh. And that each one of them should have some sort of commemoration of Amalek, which would mean now we're turning around and saying, Esther, Kel, we've been waiting for you for 1,000 years. In other words, when Moshe Rabbeinu got this mitzvah, there was like a hole there until Megillat Esther came along, and Baruch Hashem, here you are, welcome.
So why would Chachamim reject it?
Again, like I said, this entire thing is strange. because it's creating a huge problem where there should be either a little problem or no problem. And the solutions vary, and the solutions are odd. They're bizarre. Because the simple solution of the thing is to say, we were almost killed. Miraculously, Hashem saved us. We owe him Thanksgiving. Let's have Thanksgiving. And if we do it by commemorating it through lighting a candle, or commemorating it by singing this song, or by reading this text, matov, that's great. Notice, by the way, what they don't challenge. They do not challenge the establishment of a holiday. What do they challenge? Reading Megillah, and including the Megillah. Including the Megillah in the canon, and the mitzvah of reading the Megillah. What about the holiday? So turn the page, and let's learn a parak of Tanakh together. If you want the English, it's here in the middle of the table. We're going to read a parak of Tanakh. It's the longest parak in Megillat Esther, and it's so long that it got titled number one on the page. Should be number six. Okay. This is the background to give us where we are. When do the core events of the Megillah happen, meaning the plot? When does it happen, which is from the rise of Haman until the bigger rise of Haman when he's put up on a stake? When does that all happen? What time of year does it all happen? It all happens in Nisan, right? In Nisan, Haman writes the decree, and evidently somewhere between Nisan and by Sivan, it's all over. So sometime within those couple months, it's all over. The parties, the accusation, the king can't sleep, all that stuff happens throughout that period, and Haman is killed sometime in the spring. Nisan, by Sivan, he's dead. Right? The only thing that's left is that there's a document out there that says that on the 14th of Adar, 13th of Adar, sorry, the next year, meaning 8, 9, 10 months from now, all hell's going to break loose. And what is it that Mordechai and Esther are successful in getting as a countermeasure? A later document that says the Jews can defend themselves. Which means anybody who's not an absolute idiot can read the political winds and realize that the Jews are now in a position of power, and if you don't want to get killed, don't go out on the streets on 13th of Adar. Yeah, pretty obvious. Okay, let's jump ahead and see what happens. U'vishneimasar chodesh u'chodesh Adar. I mentioned this a number of times, but it's important to remember that the use of the name, of the month names, Adar, Nisan, Sivan, Tammuz, etc., and all those other names, they're all pagan names, and we never see them before the Persian period, and the only reason that we see them is because during the Persian period, we had a new experience, a new reality that we never had before, which is we are part of a larger empire. Either we were always independent, or else we were just slaves. But now we were an autonomous people in a larger empire. And as a result of that, three critical things changed among a lot of small things, which is our script changed to this script, our language changed to Aramaic, because that was the court language, and our use of the month names change to their months, because all the documents we had to write that had to be dated. So for the purposes of the Megillah uses the proper Jewish name, which is the number, and it also mentions the Goyish pagan name, you know, which is the in this case Adar. This is the time that the king's rule, which rule for both of them, came to be done, which is either A, first document, kill a Jew, get his house, right? B, Jews, defend yourselves, and you're okay. By Yom Sibru, Sibru is a word we all know from Inecholecha Yisaberu, to anticipate. Right? All of the Jews' enemies were looking forward to this day. This is the thought that they, the day that they thought that they would rule over them. V'nafochu, it became the opposite. Turned out the Jews ruled over their enemies. Nikalu Ayudim Baram. What happened? The Jews gathered in their cities, to go and kill anybody who tried to hurt them. And no, I won't read the pasuk twice. And nobody stood in front of them because they were all afraid. It was the war had already been fought months before, and now it was just a cleanup issue because everybody was afraid of the Jews. Mordechai's reputation was going, as you see, all the machers, pachot is pacha, is a governor. They're all raising and extolling the Jews. They're all afraid of Mordechai. In the palace, he's big. His reputation is growing. He's getting bigger and bigger. And that doesn't mean that he just ate like a pig. What it means is that Mordechai's reputation is getting big because you know what happens with reputations away from the scene. You know, if people met Mordechai and said, Mordechai's 6'2", by the time the board gets out of Shushan, he's 7'2". By the time he gets out into the thing, he's 10'9", and he's got arms that are the size of a building, and you know how that works, right? The reputation grows. So what happened? The Jews went out, and they smote their enemies. Right? The sword and whatever other kinds of killing, they killed them. They did whatever they want. They killed 500 people in Shushan, besides everything happening throughout the kingdom. And then we have the list of Haman's names and all the kids' names. I don't need to read them. Aser b'nei Haman, I did it in one breath. Okay, happy? Aser b'nei Haman, that I'm data tzori dim haragu. Wait, when did Haman get killed? Months ago.
Yeah.
Why are his sons killed? Well, ostensibly, because his sons are part of the war against the Jews. The only problem is that if you read Parakhet, you'll read that Mordechai already owned them and they were his slaves. So this seems to be, this seems, no, on Pesach time or sometime before the 25th of Sivan. So the sons are killed, and it's, ostensibly it's some sort of vengeance thing, or like, let's wipe out Haman. So they take that day and they kill him. All right, how did they kill him? Parenthetically? What? By the sword. No, by the sword. They still look on the sword. You'll see. By Yomahu Bamisparo, give me Shushan of Yerad Fan Melech. All right, now the king got the report. Now the queen is the regular, now she's coming in freely. Right? So 510 people are killed in Shushan. 500 plus the 10 Bnei Haman. Clearly, their death is a separate thing. It's some sort of an execution type thing. What happened everywhere else? And again, the king repeats that refrain. What do you want, Esther? You know, half the kingdom, etc. But what does she request? I need one more day to extend the decree for Shushan for the Jews to fight. So they need to be able to fight tomorrow also because they haven't finished their fighting. To take the carcasses of Haman's 10 sons and string put them up on a stake. Right? They were killed, however they're killed. Now put the carcasses up so everybody can see you don't mess with the Jews. All right. Now what happened? The king ordered that. Okay, and now get ready, because now we're going to get into what we're really here for, although it's always pleasurable to read this. So the Jews also defended themselves and killed 300 more of their enemies on the 14th in Shushan. They did not touch any of the loot, even though they were allowed to, and Haman's sons are already waving in the wind. And they killed some enormous amount of people out in the hinterlands. When did all that happen? On the 13th of Adar. Now, let's get to it. And this is where Purim starts. V'noach b'arba'a sarbo. So they fought on the 13th. What did they do the next day? They rested. They beat their enemies. They rested. What did they do on the 14th of Adar that year in the hinterlands? What did they do? They partied. Of course they partied. Why not? There was a threat hanging over their head for almost a year. Yesterday, they convincingly and with a landslide wiped out their enemies. So a party. Everybody bring out some drinks, bring out some meat, bring out the streets. Big party, the whole city. Right? All these little hamlets, these Jewish hamlets, and they're all celebrating on the 14th of Adar that year. That's it. That year. Now, by the way, they don't call it Purim. They just go out and celebrate. Okay. Let me ask you one other thing before we go a little further. What language is Megillat Esther that we have in? The one that we have, what language is it in? Chiefly Hebrew with a fairly liberal sprinkling of Persian words because there's also the Persian things like names for groups and particular horse riders or whatever it is. Okay, good. Now, in only one case is a word translated for us in the Megillah. Months are translated. Every time there's a month, it's translated. Chodesh HaRishon or Chodesh Nisan. Chodesh HaNisan, Chodesh Adar. There's only one word which says blank, hu ha blank. What's that? Pur, hu ha goral. So why? Why doesn't the Megillah just say that Haman threw a goral down? He threw a goral. Goral is a Hebrew word. We know what it is. Why say he threw a goral? It's very simple why. Because what's the name of the holiday? Purim. Purim is not a Hebrew word. It's a Persian word. I have no idea what Purim is until the Megillah tells me. Pur hu agoral. Now I know what it is. So if I wanted to call it something in Hebrew, I'd call it goralot. All right? Call it Yom Mordechai better. But, okay. Vayedim asher shani kalub, shlosha asara wasabob, nachum chomisha asara wasoto yom mishteh l'simcha. What did the Jews in Shushan do? They fought on the 13th and 14th. What did they do the next day? Same thing. They went out and partied. It's very reasonable, very understandable. Okay? By the way, if you stop the Megillah at this point, what do we have a story of? We have a story of a threat, intrigue, street battle, victory, party. See you around. And there's nothing on my calendar that has anything to do with this. And no, I don't go running to the shops the day after Halloween to try to get closeouts on costumes. I got no interest in that if I stop there. Al-Kain. This sounds like Kiddush, but Al-Kain. Hayudima parazim ayoshvim barea prazot. There's a little bit of a play on words here, but what does paruz mean in Hebrew? Paruz means unwalled. Unwalled. So ayudima parazim ayoshvim barea prazot. The Jews living in the unwalled cities. By the way, there is a clever play on words on here, but without knowing ancient Farsi, you wouldn't know what it is. And that is that paruz in ancient Farsi means victorious. So now you look at the pasuk and you see what a clever play it is. The victorious Jews living in the unwalled cities. What does osim mean? Osim. What does that mean? They do. Not they did, but they do. Which means, when is this pasuk written?
Later.
This pasuk written years later, when it's describing an ongoing custom that exists in the unwalled cities. And that is, that they make the 14th into a party. By the way, the 14th. What day should be the party?
The
13th. The 13th is the day they won. 13th should be the party. Instead, every year on the 14th, they make a party, and what do? Simcha u'mishteh v'yom tov. Mishteh just means a feast, rejoicing. Yom tov may mean that there was an attempt, and the Gemara says there was such an attempt, to actually make it a full bona fide yom tov. But what else did they add? Umishloach manot ishtereyu, which means what? What is mishloach manot ishtereyu? It means you share your meal. You share your meal with each other. Yeah, but that's later than this. It's later than this. Vayichtov Mordechai et ha-devarim ha-ele. You're thinking about the case of Rashan in Chemichet. Tov Mordechai et ha-devarim ha-ele. Vayishtach tzvei v'kol yidim ha-shem v'chol midot ha-melech ha-tzvosh ha-kuvim v'ha-chokim. Now, what do we have at this point? At this point, we have the events took place in a particular year. In each place, the day after the war took place, the locals spontaneously had a party. And then we find out that in the unwalled cities, they made the party a permanent thing on the day of the party, not the day of the victory. Strange. And now Mordechai writes a letter. By the way, who was not celebrating in year two?
Say that again.
Who was not celebrating in year two? Shushan. Says the unwalled cities are celebrating. What about Shushan? They're not celebrating. You want to know why they're not celebrating? For a very obvious reason. How are you going to go marching, having a parade, going down the street, celebrating the victory of, oh yeah, we killed your uncle, and we killed your cousin, right there in the city? So the Ramban suggests that Shushan was the only city the Jews lived in that was cosmopolitan. Otherwise, they lived in Jewish-only cities. Which would mean then that the Shushan is the only place we're celebrating is a little bit of a problem. What that means then is that in every other city, the enemies came from the neighboring town, they beat them off, they killed some of them, and then they got their own town to celebrate in.
Were there Jews lived in the whole city?
What?
The Jews lived in their own city?
That was the Ramban's take. The Jews lived in small Jewish hamlets, which is very likely considering the Persian Empire, and that the only city in which Jews lived, in which there was a walled city and everything else, it was cosmopolitan, Jews and non-Jews together, was Shushan.
They're spread out,
exactly. Spread out would mean that, remember, Haman never told Ahasuerus Jews. Haman's lying through his teeth, so what? Haman will lie about anything he can't get caught about. So that's, but they are spread out. How far spread out are they? We don't have a record of Jews being in India. We don't have a record of Jews being in Africa, below Egypt.
Amongst the Goyim, they lived.
No, that's not what it means. Spread throughout the kingdom means that they're scattered as opposed to being in one place. And the Gemara's take on that is that his argument is that if you wipe them out, it won't be like there'll be a big vacuum somewhere.
But they have
their own, yeah, that's the Ramban's take. All right, but either way, what's clear from here is that the Jews in Shushan are not celebrating the second year and everybody else is. So now, Mordechai writes a document. What hat does Mordechai wear? Who is Mordechai? What? Who is he in the text, very clearly?
Uncle.
He's not. Right.
He.
No, but who is he at this point in the text? He's the hero of the Jews. He's also the viceroy of Persia. He wears two hats. Okay, this is like if Joe Lieberman had also become, you know, like the head of some federation or something. And he was also vice president. So when Joe Lieberman writes a letter, what's he writing? Which stationery is he writing on? So that's the question here. He sends letters to all the Jews. On what stationery? That's the question. Watch. That they should accept. That they should celebrate on the 14th and the 15th. B'chol shana v'shana, every year. So what's he really innovating here? Which day is he innovating? The 15th. So what hat is he wearing? He's wearing the hat of the viceroy. And now when a Jew celebrates in Shushan and his neighbor starts complaining, he says, I'm just following orders. I'm just doing what the king said. Right? Mishnah HaMelech ordered me to celebrate today. What can I do? Go complain to him. Get your head cut off. And now, notice what the emphasis is. Kayamim asher nachu v'ayim ha'yidim mi'oyveihem. What does that mean? We want to celebrate Kayamin. What does that mean? That means that we are not celebrating the victory. You know what we're doing? We're reenacting the event. If we're celebrating the victory, when's the party? The 13th everywhere. But instead, what were we doing? We're reenacting the event. What was the event? They partied on the 14th. Parenthetically, what does that mean we're going to do on the 13th?
Prepare for the party.
So since we don't need to go kill everybody because they're already dead, what are we going to do? We're going to pretend that we're in a war. And what do Jews do when they're in a war when they can't fight? They fast. That's what made the Tom famous about what Tanya Esther.
Not related to
right?
Her fast.
What?
Not related to her fast.
Her fast is in Nisan and it's 3 days and who knows what that is anyways. Nisan or ER, it depends how you read it. But not now. Don't be wrong, but there are certainly opinions, many opinions, that say Tanya Esther is commemoration of her fast. Mm-hmm. And if you're interested, Mitchell First just published a book called Esther Unmasked that has 11 essays on different things of the Chagim, and one of them is on the sorts of Tanit Esther. I'm sure it's a Kedai book to get. Here we go. What did Mordechai order? Good. Very nice. And what did Mordechai add in that wasn't there? Umatanot Adyonim. That, by the way, now formally makes it a Jewish holiday, because now we are taking all of the aspects of the celebration of a Chag into account. What does Sefer Dvarim tell us consistently we have to do when we celebrate? Right? You always have to include them. So Mordechai is like putting this whole, that whole aspect on it. Now, what happened? Mordechai wrote the document. Azma. Kefaisen. It doesn't work. V'kibel ha'yudim et yashar yichel lasot. What does that word mean? V'kibel ha'yudim, meaning? Actually, v'kiblu, I understand. V'kibel ha'yudim. They accepted that which they started to do, which means they were the ones who initiated the holiday. And that's the point I want to bring you to here. Is look at the Megillah and please tell me, who created Purim? Who created Purim? Who created the holiday?
Survivors of
the people, not the rabbis, not the Beit Din, not the Chachamim, the people. The people created this holiday, right? And now that they created it, what did Mordechai then do? He enshrined it for Persian purposes, meaning into the government. The Jews celebrating on the 14th and the 15th every year is part of their hegemony, right? Part of their heritage, whatever you want to call it. And then there's this little synopsis of the story. Again, poor Gral. Good, very quick little summary of the story. Okay, and now right. And by the way, when is this final copy of the Megillah being written? Take a look at it. What do they call this day? Purim. Why do they call it Purim? Because of the poor. What's the poor? Who are Goral? Why don't the rabbis come along and say, hey guys, come on, you could have the holiday, but let's call it by a nice Jewish name, Goralot. You know why? Because they're not in charge. You know who's in charge? The people are. And they have a holiday called Purim, and they've been celebrating it for a long time. Alkein, Alkol Diverse, Agirat Azot, Marau Alkacho, Magiel Lehem. Now, famous drasha here. Kimu v'kiblu ayudim, etc. What does that mean? So what's the famous drasha, kimu v'kiblu? Kimu l'mala mashikiblu l'mata. Meaning, in Shamayim, they accepted the institution of Purim based on the Jews' acceptance. Beautiful. And you know what that drasha is cutting down to? It's cutting down to this whole shir. It's cutting to the core of this whole shir, which is, if in Israel have a celebration, our Kodesh Baruch Hu accepted it.
This is unique, right?
Absolutely unique. And that's why all the discussion we had in the first part of this year is there. That's why all the questions of Eilat Mitzvot are only raised about Purim. Because you don't ask those questions about Hanukkah. Nobody suggests that Hanukkah was something that was, you know, we generated and God approved of. We never even, if you will, needed that. The only thing we needed was, how do we get around the Asher Kiddushanu thing? But when it comes to Purim, alone among all the Mitzvot Rabbanan, we suddenly have this sense that this is something that Shemayim approved of. How do we know Shemayim approved of it? And watch how it all comes together. Shemayim approved of it because we have a book in Tanakh that therefore was written by Ruach HaKodesh that enshrines it. That means unlike Hanukkah, unlike Netilat Yadayim, unlike Eruvin, unlike other mitzvot Rabbanan, this has the prophetic edge. If it has a prophetic edge, then we have run into the risk of Eilat Mitzvot. And then we've got to crowbar our way in and say, oh, there's room for a third mention of Amalek. Oh, there's Kal v'chomer, Mital v'chayim. You understand? That's what's driving all the sugiyot on page one. Now, Kimu v'kiblu in the drasha, the famous drasha of Shmuel is, Kimu l'mala masha kiblu l'mata. What's shot in the pasuk in context? Because it's answering the question. The pasuk says, Ma higi aleim. How the Jews earn this? The answer is, Kimu v'kiblu ayudim. Alehem, the Alzaram, the Alkoh Nilvim Alehem. The Jews accepted, they fulfilled and accepted on themselves and on their kids and on anybody who would later join them. Because think about this. Somebody converts in the year 2012 and they come to celebrate Purim in the year 2015 and they say a bracha. Who saved us from our enemies? Whose enemies? Eiffel enemies. Your ancestors were Teutons at the time. The answer is that when the Jews accepted Purim, they accepted Alkol Elvim Aleim, anybody who would join them. Velo Yavor. Now, Velo Yavor is a response to all the Velo Yavors in Ahasuerus's edicts. What's the Velo Yavor? It can't be repealed. This will never be repealed, which leads to the famous Midrashim that say that all the Chagim will eventually disappear except for Purim. And all the Nevi'im and Ketuvim will eventually disappear except for Mikra Megillah. Except for Megillah. L'yot osim et shtei yamim ha'ele kichtaram v'chiz manam. What is it the Jews accepted? The Jews accepted they and their progeny and everybody who joins them will always celebrate these 2 days exactly as they are written. And in the proper time, b'chol shana v'shana. And therefore, now listen to this and tell me when it's written. Vayamim ha'ele nizkarim v'na'asim b'chol dor v'dor. These days are, or probably more accurately, have been commemorated and celebrated in every generation. So when's that the pasuk written?
Later.
That pasuk was written a long time later. After somebody can actually testify and say, we've got a holiday, and the holiday is called Purim, and it's called Purim because it's a people's holiday, and they called it Purim, and this is how it started, and this is what the people on their own generated the second year, and then Mordechai made it legal and proper by sending out documents, and for generations we've been celebrating this as a holiday called Purim, and this is the story behind it. Mishpacha, Mishpacha, Medina, Medina, Ve'ir, Ve'ir. which may mean it's inclusive, and no matter where you live and everything else, you all celebrate it. Chachamim darshan is pasuk to refer to the 15th and the 14th, but it could also mean that everybody has their own particular slant on how they celebrate it, each family, each city, etc., but we all celebrate it in this manner, generally, on this time. These days are never going to disappear. Never be gone. Okay? And what happens is the coda to this. What does kol tokef mean? It means all power. But what kind of power are we talking about? Legal power. The queen and the viceroy write a document with all this power. Hold on one second. So that we're admitting there's a second letter here. A later letter. And that is now given all power to fulfill it. What is that? So in other words, Esther and Mordechai send out a document with all legal and empire power that the Jews have to fulfill these days. To commemorate what Esther and Mordechai themselves went through and for their kids. Right? Which seems to indicate, and this is why some people think Tanit Esther Zecher to her fast. They were the fast and they're crying out. Okay. So now what do we see in this entire scope, which is the most halachic chapter, maybe comparable to Ruth Dalad, but the most halachic chapter in all of Nevi'im K'tuvim. More halachot, more practices, more legal talk, if you will. What is it we see here? We see here that Purim was created as a result of the people's initiative and then the people's steadfastness in trying to make this a permanent holiday where it was safe to do it. Mordechai stepped in to make it safe everywhere, and now the Jews continued to commit to themselves and to their children and to everybody else who would come along, they must always celebrate this holiday in every generation. Now you come along and say a couple hundred years later and turn around and say, wait, time out, wait a second, we're not allowed to add. Nobody asked about Hanukkah, nobody asked about any of the other things they ask about here, because the claim here is that there is a prophetic component to it, which goes hand in hand with the fact that Megillat Esther is in Tanakh. And that's where we find Megillat Esther getting into Tanakh via the Amalek opening, both in Bavli and Yerushalmi, finding room for a mention of Amalek in Ketuvim, either because Vasefer is a reference to Megillat Esther, or because Ketuv Zot Zikaron Vasefer just allows for three, and this is the third mention of Amalek. So we turn all of this, and so I'll take a question in a second, we turn all of this now inside out and say, okay, so Purim, on the one hand, has a top-down confirmation, but on the other hand, is an absolutely grassroots holiday. Starts from grassroots, generated by the people, and not only in their behavior, but in their celebration and in their continued celebration. And that's something that, of course, in a sense, that may be why Purim of all holidays is guaranteed in the Midrash as being permanent. Because something which is created by the people, in a sense, is even more beloved by HaKadosh Baruch Hu than that which he gives us himself.
One comment and one question.